You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is March 6th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey everybody.
Jay Novella.
400!
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
And we have a special guest rogue with us this evening, George Hrob. George, welcome back.
This isn't The Price is Right. Jay, you lied to me.
What else is new?
No, but this is our 400th episode.
No, it's not, Jay. Next week is our 400th episode.
$3.99,
and that's a bargain.
We are not round number bigots here anyway, because that's all superstitious nonsense.
Roundists. You're all roundists.
Roundists. So Rebecca's voice is still recovering from whatever infection she had. So she is, again, not with us this week. But George will be taking her place and speaking in falsetto the entire show.
Yes. I'm so skeptical. It's not a Rebecca impression. It's not a Rebecca impression at all. Just so we get that clear.
We got that.
All right, good.
So we were just talking before the show, like saying hi to George and everything, and it occurred to me, I wanted to ask George this question. George, you ever listen to a podcast?
Ever listening to Parent Flying? No, sorry, go ahead. Sorry. Have I ever listened to it?
Has this ever happened where you're listening to a show that you've recorded and somebody says your name in the podcast and you answer them in real time? Like, it just happened to me 2 days ago. I was listening to one of our shows and Steve says, "So Jay," and I actually go, "Yeah." I'm like, "Whoa."
Oh boy.
He's not in the car with me. I'm not on the phone with him. I'm hearing him in the podcast.
I don't listen to my show because I don't really like my show.
Yeah.
But, well, no, but sound effects that I've done before have scared the hell out of me. I'll forget that I, you know, inserted an airplane or something and it'll scare the crap out of me. Or like a doorbell sound or something. Yeah. But I don't actually, because I'm the only person on my show, for me to respond to myself as if I was actually talking to myself, I think would be indicative of something really scary and awesome. So,
All right, that is a good point.
But I'll respond if you ask. And if I listen to this show, I'll make sure that every time you say, "Hey, George," no matter where I am, I'll say, "What? Oh, damn. What? What? Oh, okay. Damn."
With a head turn,
yes,
right?
Nerd, as if you're looking over Scooby-Doo your right shoulder. Hmm?
Scooby's neck.
Hey, George. Evan is going to tell us about this day in skepticism.
All right. So March 9th, and the year was 1851. Now, we all know who Hans Christian Ørsted was.
Hans Christian Ørsted.
I have no idea who he is.
Well, he was a Danish. Oh, I'm sorry. Wait. He was a Danish physicist. And a chemist.
And delicious.
I see.
Who made a discovery. He discovered that an electric current in a wire causes a nearby magnetized compass needle to deflect, indicating the electric current in a wire induces a magnetic field around it.
That is awesome.
That is awesome. You could
just retire after making that discovery. I'm done. I've made my contribution.
Little electromagnetic theory for you there?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, but how do you monetize that? I mean, that's the problem.
Yeah.
What do you do with that? You know, I mean, what is that? What kind of invention could that possibly lead to? Yeah, it's a great magic trick, but what are you going to do with that?
It's just a laboratory curiosity.
That's
nothing
right.
To see
it took 100 years for them to slap one of those suckers in a bracelet.
And then you get the real money.
A bracelet made of perhaps aluminum. Hey, speaking of aluminum.
Yeah,
aluminum.
Ørsted also was the first one to produce metallic aluminum.
Oh.
Aluminum, do you guys know how common
as
it is?
Opposed to rubber aluminum?
No, as opposed to aluminum oxide or aluminum silicate. So aluminum is the third most abundant element in the Earth's crust. I know you guys all know that because I told you that before. I used to know that, yes. After oxygen and silicon. Which is why there's lots of aluminum oxides and aluminum silicates. And he figured out how to make metallic aluminum. Although it was up to later chemists to figure out how to really industrialize that process. If you recall, we talked about the fact that when aluminum was first available as a metal, it was more expensive than gold.
I recall nothing.
It was considered a rare and exotic metal, and things made out of aluminum were like a status symbol. But then later chemists figured out how to make massive quantities of it just from dirt, basically, and, you know, from bauxite specifically.
So did any scientist like cash in at that moment? Like, okay, I figured out how to make it. Yes. It's everywhere.
Let's sell it now.
Well, yeah. Did somebody become a trillionaire for like the first 3 years or what
American
happened?
Aluminum, you know, I think was the name of the company that, became very wealthy mass producing aluminum. And the price went from hundreds of dollars an ounce to pennies a pound.
Mm. Oof. See, Alcoa shouldn't have waited.
Yeah, Alcoa, that's it.
Bad investment.
Guess I shouldn't have invested in that company early on, huh?
Well, you shouldn't have invested in aluminum. The company did quite well, actually. Now, did you also know that Hans Christian Oersted was a very close friend of Hans Christian Andersen?
Seriously?
That's what I was going to say.
No way.
Yeah, and I actually don't know exactly who Hans Christian Andersen is or what. What's his deal? Well, who's that guy?
Come on, Jay.
He wrote stories.
It's Danny Kaye.
That's right. Danny
Little Thumbelina.
Little Mermaid.
Thumbelina.
Little Mermaid.
Did he sing The Little Mermaid?
I think he played the crab in the movie, actually. Oh, aluminum.
Nice.
He wrote famous fairy tales. But so how did these guys meet? Like at a Hans Christian organization or something?
Convention?
Yeah,
I know. Convention. Famous people named Hans Christian.
There's a Facebook page, wasn't it? It just...
Right.
I guess.
Did they get each other's mail? I mean, what happened?
My money's on the fact that maybe like half the population is just named Hans Christian something.
Maybe.
I think it's a coincidence.
And March 9th, 1851 was the day that we lost Hans Oersted.
Yes.
So Hans Christian Oersted. So we mourn Hans Christian Oersted on this day, but thank you so much for all that electromagnetism. It is doing us wonders these days.
And aluminum. Yep.
Yeah, that too.
So, George, before we go on to news items, what's new with you?
What's new? Goodness. What isn't? Actually,
it's a shorter list.
The newest thing is a number of you, rogues, were at the 21812 concert that happened last year.
Yes, loved it.
Sure it was.
Show, and we are furiously editing and putting together what looks to be just an incredible DVD. Of that performance, which is the audio mixing. I was at Slough's yesterday, as a matter of fact. So the audio mixing is done, a monumental effort. And now the video is being edited, and there's going to be commentary and a documentary, and it's going to be really, really fantastic. That is the thing which is occupying the most frontal part of my frontal creative lobe right now is the 21812 concert. So
it only took a year.
When's it coming out?
Yeah, I know.
When are we going to get a copy?
It'll be weeks. Months? Weeks. Well, I guess months are made up of weeks, so I'm not lying in either direction. But weeks.
No. As long as it's more than 1 month. Right.
Right.
So I have some good news, everyone.
Bad news.
Okay, what's up?
Did you hear about the girl who was cured of HIV?
In spite of the incompetence of her mom, apparently.
Her mother appears to be troubled. I don't know if incompetence is her problem or if it's other things. But so the story, here's the story. The mother, who was HIV infected, presented for delivery with apparently no prenatal care and delivered a child who was positive for HIV within 30 hours of being born. So almost certainly infected in utero. The doctor who was consulted, an HIV infectious disease specialist at the time, who was consulted on the case, not really sure why, but decided to treat the child earlier than is typically treated. So at 31 hours, the infant was treated with antiretroviral therapy. And also, she decided to give the infant
extra.
Well, not extra, so therapeutic doses as opposed to preventive or prophylactic doses. So that's
what's the difference?
It's a higher dose. Yeah. So a therapeutic dose is meant to treat an existing infection, whereas a preventive dose is meant to prevent an exposure from establishing itself as an infection.
You could call that extra, I think.
Yeah. So, well, it was, she gave the higher dose, the therapeutic dose.
Extra.
And,
not the gum, the actual medicine, right? I mean,
yeah, the antiretroviral therapy, ART.
Because that would be something if extra gum cured AIDS. That would be, wow.
This is a Hannah Gay, a pediatric infectious disease specialist. And the child was treated with ART for the first 18 months of life or thereabouts. At that point, she was lost to follow-up, as we say. She stopped being brought back in by the mother for treatment. Now, Dr. Gay diligently tracked down the mother and the child through the police in order to bring the child back in for health care. So now it was like 7 or 8 months, the child has been getting no medication. The mother was going through some kind of life situation. Apparently has a lot of challenges. And not giving the kid their medicine, not bringing them into doctor's visits. So Dr. Gay at this point thought, okay, so now we have a 2-year-old who has gone 6, 7, 8 months with no medication therapy. Their viral loads are going to be off the charts.
Right, because typically what happens, Steve, is when you're taking, when you're going through that process, the virus is pretty much just go into hiding, right? They just like say, screw it, I'm just going to hang out and wait till the weather's better. And then once you stop it, bam, they come out. And that's what he expected.
That's what Gay
expected.
What typically happens is in an HIV-infected individual, if they're treated with ART, then the viral loads will drop to undetectable levels. But the virus still lives on in the body in these hidden reservoirs. As you say, they go into hiding. And these reservoirs are isolated from the immune system so that they can persist despite the retroviral therapy. And if you stopped the retroviral therapy, antiretroviral therapy, then the infection would come back, would rebound because of these reservoirs. So, checked out the child, did the viral loads, they were still undetectable. There was no sign of HIV in the child at all. Went back to check everything. So now she thinks, all right, there's something interesting going on here. She checked a number of things. She had got other specialists involved as well. First, they confirmed that yes, she was indeed infected with HIV as a newborn. They confirmed that. Two, that the strain of HIV is a wild type strain. That's not some mutated strain. It's not a weakened strain. It's a regular strain of HIV. Three, they tested the mother and the child to see if they happen to have a genetic type that makes them resistant to HIV, because there are people out there who are naturally resistant to HIV, and they did not, so they did not have any of the known forms of resistance.
Three great tests. It was like, yeah, it didn't occur to me that they should do that, but when I read it, I'm like, of course, that's exactly what you would need to do to really be secure in your conclusion.
So, yeah. Well, plus, I think at this point, they were planning on publishing, and of course, you want to get all your ducks in a row if you do that.
Right.
And in fact, they did present this case at a conference and reported all these details. And so they discovered that she was infected. It was a normal virus. They're not resistant. And, even 6, 7 months after stopping ART, the virus never rebounded. They're calling this a functional cure. Functional cure. Not an outright cure. I think because they did really, really sensitive tests for HIV, RNA and DNA. And and a couple of these tests showed really minuscule little remnants of RNA or DNA.
Yeah, but didn't they describe them as like non-functional or they did not have the ability to reproduce?
So they are not replication competent.
They
are not replication competent. But I guess it means it's not completely out of the system. But what it does mean is that the virus will not rebound. It is not established. There's no active reservoirs of the virus, and the child will be able to go to live their life without the need for further ART or antiretroviral therapy.
So we're not looking at some state of remission that's currently going
on. Remission is not an unreasonable term to use. It's a remission without medication, without needing further medication treatment. Functional cures is the specific term that they used. This is only the second case of any human being who is known to be infected with HIV who then was cured. The first one was a gentleman who got a bone marrow transplant in Germany from a donor who is HIV resistant. They were apparently cured by that bone marrow transplant, basically given a new immune system resistant to the HIV. This is now the second case.
Does this help the world, Steve? Can we use this information in any way?
Well, yeah, sure, yeah. I mean, look at the children born with AIDS, like in Africa. I mean, the United States is not so much of a huge deal as it is in Africa. But Jay, there's like, the statistic was crazy. It was like, you know, thousands of kids per picosecond in Africa.
But my question is, does that case, the second case of this child, does it actually help scientists figure out how to use that to make, you know, some type of cure?
So here's the bottom line.
We have to weaponize the baby, I think. That's the,
weaponize it. The nice. Stats are about 130 children per year develop HIV from their mother in the United States, but it's about 1,000 children per day worldwide in developing countries. So that's a lot. That's 1,000 kids per day.
Why is that woman having so many children? I'm sorry.
What this suggests is that the standard of care for treating newborns born of infected mothers might be, rather than giving prophylactic doses, but to give therapeutic doses earlier to try to prevent the virus from ever establishing an infection, which seems to be the case here. The virus never got itself established. Here's the trick, though, is that, I mean, it's got to be studied. This is a case. This is an anecdote, right? It's interesting, but it's one case. And it's hard to extrapolate from that. So it needs to, so this will lead to research looking at this approach to show that it's safe, to show that it's effective. What's going to be tricky, so let's say you get 100 kids, you know, or 200 kids, 100 you give the standard therapy, the other 100 you give this early aggressive therapy, you track them over a few years. To really know that the children have been functionally cured, you would want to actually stop their ART. That's going to be tricky to do.
That's tough.
Because that, ethically, how are you going to do that? We're not going to give you proven therapy to see how you're doing. So the best they could hope to do would be to follow a lot of children and then track those whose parents stopped giving them the medication due to noncompliance or whatever. Yeah. Like in this case, you know, you can't randomly choose people not to get treatment and just to see how they do. That's the definition of unethical research. But you may be able to track cases where the children stop getting their drugs for one reason or another and see how they do. And maybe you can gather enough information from that to say, okay, it's reasonable in these cases with these outcomes to reduce the medication and see how they do, maybe wean them off, tracking them carefully, you know. So it's not going to instantly lead to replicating this exact treatment paradigm, but it will, I think, probably it'll lead to studying this higher, more aggressive early treatment, which may lead to curing infants who otherwise would have been infected with HIV. But this is using drugs that are already in existence to treat HIV. This is not a new treatment or a new cure. This is not a cure for people in whom infection is already established. You might think that maybe the same applies if you, let's say, get exposed to HIV. Again, instead of getting preventive doses, maybe even as an adult, you know, you would be given therapeutic doses right away, just accidentally.
Yeah, not take hold.
When you say therapeutic doses, you mean, like, you know, a large amount.
Well, the doses that are normally given to people with HIV infection, as opposed to preventive doses, which are doses given to people who have been exposed but who are not infected, in order to reduce the risk of the exposure resulting in an infection.
When I read this story, it was amazing. And I remember, like, one of the first things that popped into my head was the idea that the kid at one point was outside of the care of the hospital, wherever that was, 7 months or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And that someone is going to latch on to something the kid did in those 7 months and say that is the actual cure.
You know what I mean?
Like, she's going to have Fruit Loops or something, and they're going to say, yeah, the fact that she had Fruit, you know, forget the hospital. It was the Fruit Loops that cured. Here's proof. Like, that was the first, the woo radar warning system that I have installed in my brain was like, oh man, okay, let no one take advantage of those 7 months where the kid was outside of, you know, supervised care or whatever to claim that that's some kind of secret,
cure. Man. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, I agree. Jeez.
I haven't heard anything about it yet, but yeah, that's always a risk. There was a lot of sensational reporting of this story. I mean, it's fascinating enough as it is, but I think my radar goes up. You talk about the skeptical radar. My skeptical radar always goes up whenever I see the word cure in the headline in any article, especially when it's connected to AIDS or cancer or the common cold or
beef
whatever.
Jerky.
There's certain
acne.
Yeah, there's certain things where it's like, really? I mean, no, we did not cure AIDS. I'm sorry. We did not cure HIV. This is a very interesting case and has implications for research and for treatment. But no, this isn't the discovery of a cure for HIV.
Steve, so what if a parent has AIDS, they have a kid, and they're like, I want my kid to get a therapeutic dose ASAP.
Yeah.
What can they do? Because that's what I would do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Enter a trial. you know, enter a clinical trial in which that is being done and take your chance that you'll get randomized to getting it.
Is it hard to get into a trial?
Well, right now, none exist, but I'm sure it will take time to get them up and running. I don't know how many and how many people are going to be introduced. So probably in the U.S., given that the number is so low, of number of kids who get infected this way because of prenatal care, et cetera, because you know, normally what you would do is aggressively treat the mother, get the viral loads down as low as possible, so that the risk of the so-called vertical transmission from mother to child is minimized. This mother didn't do that. That's partly why the child was infected. So this is the exact people who are going to end up infected as an infant are the ones that are going to be difficult to recruit, and there aren't that many of them. So it's probably going to be more, it's going to be hard to get people into this trial as opposed to people having a hard time getting into such trials. You know what I mean? If you're the kind of parent who is going to seek out that kind of aggressive care, you're probably not the kind of parent who is going to give birth to an infected child in the first place. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah. Where's the father through all this, I wonder?
No mention in anything.
Yeah. I wonder what his situation is.
Obviously, the doctors are being keeping confidential the personal details. They're just saying she had some life situation that, you know, intervened, but we have no idea what that was, but clearly she's troubled.
I mean, it still won't be an outright cure, because if you have the infection, this won't work, but for people who just get it, it will be a cure for them.
Was treated at 30 hours of life.
Yeah.
How many people don't even find out that they've been exposed until...
That's it. That's the...
Days later. So one example would be a healthcare worker who stabs himself with an HIV-infected needle.
Yep. Perfect.
You would be in the clinic in 15 minutes. In fact, I did that to myself once, not with an HIV.
Really?
Not with an HIV infected needle. I stuck myself with a Hep C needle.
How'd you do it?
Oh man, I hate when that happens.
Did you lose a bet?
No. It was an accident. I did what I wasn't supposed to. I recapped a needle. The needle went right through the cap and into my finger.
Jeez.
And you were right in front of a patient?
Yeah.
What'd you do?
I finished what I was doing. I went to the health services and got two huge needles of gamma globulin injected into my buttocks.
Gamma globulin.
Wait a second. One per
cheek.
Yep.
Steve, I have to ask more detail. Did you keep your composure?
Of course.
Like, did you go, oh holy shit, like run out and like
you're all gonna die!
Give me those ass needles.
On panic day, yeah.
It was not panic day.
Oh God.
Unlike today.
Were you embarrassed? Is it like you shamefully like go to some guy sitting at a desk and you're like,
Yes, I was stupid. Yes. It was dumb. I was a medical student.
Did they say anything to you? Like, did they make you feel really weird?
No.
Steve's heart rate increased by 2 beats per minute.
Were they messing with you? Like, we got to do a biopsy, and now we got to do this, we got to do that.
No, they're my physician now. They acted totally professional.
All right, Steve, put this in a little context.
It's no fun.
Hepatitis C, how bad are we talking?
That's bad. It's like a chronic liver infection. It would be very bad.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I got for the treatment for that, it's gamma globulin, so like pooled antibodies. And so it's a huge dose that they have to get.
A bolus? They call that a bolus?
So, yes.
If they give you enough of that gamma globulin, Steve, can you turn into the Hulk?
I was just going to say that, Jay.
So this is what I remember
nice,
about that.
Jay.
The first injection was very painful. The second injection was 10 times as painful.
Yeah, but
10 times.
It was so much more painful. And the reason for that probably...
Why? It's not supposed to go in your penis. That's the problem.
We got to get this in there.
It's a really long needle.
When you get the first injection, your body excretes chemicals which sort of prime it for pain. And so then when you get the second injection, it has a huge exaggerated local response to the injection.
Thank you, body. Isn't that convenient?
Well, okay.
Why is that happening?
They should give you both needles
at
once.
So you never do it again,
Jay. 1, 2, 3, jab.
Yeah, I don't know what would be worse.
That's crazy.
Two at once, two needles at once.
But this was, whatever, 20 years ago, so I know I'm out of the window. I never got a hep problem.
Are you sure?
No hep C.
Yeah. But I could definitely imagine the panic of jabbing yourself with an HIV-infected needle. That would be panic time.
It just shows you how dangerous healthcare is. I mean, these professionals, doctors,
this was also, this was, you know, not in the early, early days, but, you know, this is earlier in the whole HIV situation. So, you know, the protocols for preventing these things were not as well established. And, you know what I mean? In my own
days. They'd have you rub garlic on the wound and rub some prayer beads.
So like now, I mean, the needle that I was using at that time doesn't even exist now, really. I mean, everything is, you know, made to prevent this from happening. Anyway, Let's move on. Bob, you're going to tell us about the comet that's going to smack right into Mars.
Yeah.
Cool.
You guys remember, I recently mentioned that this will be remembered maybe as the year of the asteroid. But now I think it will be, in retrospect, in the future, considered the year of the asteroid slash comet.
The slash comet.
The big news in recent days is not only do we have the Pan-STARRS comet, which will be visible in mid-March 2013, and also the ISON comet, which could be awesome. Very bright in November 2013, but now we also have the Sliding Spring, an oddly named comet, which could potentially hit the planet Mars in October 2014. Not quite this year, but coming up relatively soon. So that, is kind of exciting, I think. It's not the Earth, so it's all good. This new comet was discovered January 3rd, this year, 2013, by famous comet hunter Robert McNaught. He actually has 74 comets on his resume.
Wow.
So how cool
Bob,
is that?
Bob, does he hang them like on the wall? Like yeah, he puts them on a plaque?
I would create a little comet after everyone that I discovered. And he also discovered asteroids. So this guy is very prolific.
You discovered that asteroids exist?
No. Just, discovered asteroids.
The game asteroids.
Specific asteroids.
Yes. So this is, apparently this is a new or virgin comet, never having been in our local area of the solar system before. And I think they believe this because of the eccentricity of its orbit after it was ejected from the Oort cloud of billions of comets that are in orbit about a light year, I think, from the sun. Billions and billions of these guys, and occasionally one will come careening in.
Billions and billions.
Billions, yes. So
that's about a Sagan.
A virgin comet has no tail.
Okay.
Dead Nothing. Comets tell Nothing no tail.
So, so
tough crowd. It's a tough crowd.
Seriously, yeah.
Tough
crowd.
George, I'm laughing.
No, yeah.
George is grabbing his tie as we speak right now.
I'm laughing on the inside.
I thought that was going to kill me. I was all excited. I was all pleased. Zilch. Loser.
That's all right. You had some good ones so far already. So the big question in my mind is this sucker going to hit Mars? And the answer is nobody knows. Not yet anyway. Some projections put the comet within 23 to 63,000 miles away from Mars at its closest approach. That's, 37 to about 100,000 kilometers away.
Hey, Bob, the orbiter we have one or more than one around Mars. Is it going to be close enough that it's going to be able to capture this thing for us? We can be able to get a good view of it.
It might be whacked.
It depends. It depends actually on various variables. But yeah, they could potentially get a really good view of this. Although there are certain things that could make it, not as, as awesome as it could be. Depending on the various factors of the approach and things. But as you know, though, as we've talked about this, the estimates of the future positions of these objects are very difficult because you need to take a nice long look at its orbit so that you can accurately extrapolate, right? And, one thing I wasn't quite aware of, though, is that this is even more problematic with comets because think about it. You've got these frozen gases on this comet. They heat up because it's getting close to the sun and then they explosively sublimate and they turn from ice to gas. Very quickly. And so it's like these little geysers that are erupting on the comet. And this, of course, is what creates the tail. That can change the orbit. As you can, you know, imagine these little geysers erupting. That could subtly, I mean, not a lot, but it can change the orbit of the comet a
like
tiny
little
bit.
Jets.
And right. And enough. This thing is going to be so close to Mars as it is that it could actually make it hit it or even miss it by even a greater distance. So right now we really won't know until probably the earliest, I think, is late summer is when we could really be confident of what's going to happen. Chances are, unfortunately, it's not going to hit. Well, I guess it depends how you look at it. But if it did hit, whoa. I mean, we're talking mega hit. This thing's 5 to 30 miles across. This thing will be coming in at about, say, 55 kilometers or 33 miles per second.
Jeez.
I mean, this thing coming in so fast. That is kinetic energy. They're talking, the impact equivalent of a billion megatons. That's a petaton. equivalent to a one petaton nuke.
Bob, you like petatons?
I love petatons. They're awesome.
You're a pedophile?
Yeah, good one. Go for the easy one, Steve. That was good.
See, Bob, so, there's the horizon. Yeah, did you see it coming?
That's with a T, by the way, not a D. Now, that's millions of times bigger than anything that we've ever detonated. We're talking about a crater that could be hundreds of miles or kilometers across. This it would be devastating.
Swallow one of our.
I want this thing to hit Mars so badly, and I want one of our rovers to have a safe front row seat to film this entire thing. But the problem is, I don't think there won't be anywhere safe on the planet, even if it was on the other side. This thing could be so devastating. It could take out every probe on the planet or in orbit. It won't matter where you are. It could wipe out everything. And that would clearly suck.
Would it be worth it, though, to get the video?
Think about the time and effort and future science that we would be getting out of these things, all wiped out in an hour. Bam, game over, you're done. But yeah, the video, the YouTube video that came out of that would be epic. Totally epic. So.
And is that going to ruin the geologic history of Mars?
No, in what way, Jay?
Not all of it.
It's going to hit the last colony of life on Mars and wipe it out.
The canals?
There's some bacterial
colony. Group of cells up there is all getting psyched.
Living in this little frozen, this little underground pond.
Let me clarify, guys. Let me clarify. So we have a petaton object hitting the surface of Mars. Couldn't that breach get down to the mantle and actually...
Well, the Martian crust is a little thicker than Earth's. Mars's crust is 50 kilometers thick on average, while Earth's is 40 kilometers on average. And the mantle is still hot. So, like Earth, Mars has a relatively thin crust. It also has a much thinner atmosphere, only 1/100th the thickness that of Earth. So that's less of a cushion to slow down anything incoming like a comet. But I don't know if this could carry the punch necessary to crack open the crust down to the mantle.
Yeah, and that'll be a deep crater, Jay.
Couldn't that kick up enough matter into the tiny atmosphere that there is and actually just screw up all of that geologic information?
Oh, it'll definitely erase a lot of geological information, no question.
It could also expose a lot, too.
Yeah, I don't know about that, yeah.
I wonder if it does hit, will this be a sort of a good selling point for us to, come up with some kind of comet, deterrent system, asteroid deterrent system? Look at Mars. Just look at what happened. It could be
Earth could be next.
I'm just saying. So. It'd be nice, right?
Absolutely. That's one of the big benefits of the Russian asteroid recently, that people are like, oh boy, we got to really, start taking this seriously. If something like that hit Mars and with such a devastating effect and we've filmed it in all its glory, that would spur us even more. And so in that regard, I think that would be a great benefit of this thing taking out Mars.
So I'm having mixed feelings about wanting this comet to hit Mars or not. It would be uber cool in many ways, but I don't want all of NASA's probes to be destroyed. That would suck.
In one fell swoop, which of course the conspiracy theorists would say, this was man-made. We steered the comet towards Mars to wipe out so that our probes wouldn't run into the secret,
what if the comet hits Cydonia? Like it hits face on Mars.
I was just thinking that, Steve. I was just thinking that. That would be, I really hope that doesn't happen because that would be too much of a coincidence.
Face on Mars.
You see that?
We could do a graph.
Put the pieces together, man. Put the pieces together.
Yeah, we're getting there. That's our next item. But, so, Bob, what I read, though, is that the current estimate is that there's a 0.1% chance that the nucleus of the comet will directly hit Mars.
Yeah, it's looking unlikely, very unlikely, even right now before we know the orbit. Yeah. But it's not completely ruled out, and who knows? These are comets, and they are inherently harder to predict than asteroids.
But even if it's not a direct hit, though, there's a good chance that
the coma?
The coma will pass through Mars, essentially.
Coma over?
Yeah. You got a coma over, yeah.
If it does hit, though, what happens to all the life force vampires that are in the comet? Are they affected by a hit?
I know what you're thinking of, George.
Damn right.
Yep.
Right, my vote is I don't want it to hit.
Enough said.
Jay votes no. What do you say, Evan?
Absolutely yes. It's a, not even once in a lifetime chance. Once in a, species time chance for this to happen.
Yeah, I want
George,
to see Mars split in two.
I want it to hit, but I want it to hit like on the far side so we can't see it. Right. Just to really be like, oh, dude, so dumb.
So you want the worst case scenario. Yes.
Yeah, I want a massive impact.
It wipes out all our probe, but we don't get to
and just,
see anything.
Yeah, this huge nerd sigh that just is like, ugh. Yeah, that's what I want.
Nerd sigh.
Oh, my God.
Let's not. Well, Steve, what do you want? You said no?
No, I said I'm conflicted. I'm very conflicted.
Don't forget, Mars has two moons.
Maybe it'll hit one of the moons.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
How cool would that be?
Not cool. It could hit one of the moons and send it towards the Earth, and then we're all effed.
No.
I'll take
that chance.
You never know, Steve.
That's what happened in Thundar the Barbarian.
All right, Jay, what are the two moons of Mars?
Yeah, there's 001 and 002.
Alpha and Beta.
Deimos and Phobos.
Phobos and Deimos, yes.
Yeah, first one, Frankie Jizmore.
And the second one is...
I love it. We have all guys on the show. Hey, Evan, you're going to tell us about the Sirius UFO documentary.
Seriously.
Yeah. Very serious. Well, we've received multiple emails and messages this week about the most recent episode of the Joe Rogan Experience, right? That's a podcast, or, you know, it's also a vodcast. But for those of you not familiar with him, Joe Rogan is an American martial artist, a stand-up comedian, an actor, a writer, and color commentator for the Ultimate Fighting Championship Mixed Martial Arts events. Now, full disclosure here. I've never seen his stand-up comedy. I've never seen him act. But I've watched him a lot of times doing UFC color. He's very good at it. And now, for the first time ever, I've listened to an entire episode of his podcast. Because he had the fella on. His name is Dr. Stephen Greer. And he has put together a documentary film that will be coming out in April called Sirius.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe Rogan spent 3 hours on his podcast talking with Dr. Stephen Greer. Yeah,
wow,
3 hours.
3 hours.
So... you know, have you guys heard of Stephen Greer before?
Oh, yeah. He's the head of the Disclosure Project.
Yeah. Disclosure Project and other little, you know, projects having to do with the world of UFOs. He's huge in the world of ufologists. He's a prominent believer and a conspiracy theorist. So if you hadn't heard of him before, consider yourself fortunate. So this is a conspiracy theorist's wet dream. Right. Dr. Greer has stitched together a narrative by which extraterrestrials, they not only exist, but they are regular visitors to Earth through space and time, and their physics-altering technologies have been co-opted by the military-industrial complex in an effort to suppress the flow of free and clean energy to the people, the masses here in
on boring.
So, and there's also a but George, there's also a shadow government. Did you know that? And it has no borders. It's very, very powerful, a couple hundred powerful people and corporations around the planet. And they are the puppet masters pulling the strings of society and technology. You know, they're oil barons and coal tycoons and nuclear hungry megalomaniacs. And they want to dominate the people of Earth by not giving them access to the alien technology that would give us clean fuel and, you know, efficient means of energy. So to top it all off, right, the coup de grace, the icing on the cake, the smoking gun, the final nail
coup
in the coffin.
We get it. It's coup de grace.
Coup de grace.
Coup de grace is acceptable.
Dr. Greer has video, photographic, and physical evidence of an extraterrestrial.
And he'll show it to you if you pay him.
If you pay him, yes. But if you look at the trailer, he'll show you a little peek of it at the very end of his trailer. It's about 6 inches long, this little thing. It looks like a little dried-out husk of what would have otherwise been that alien from the infamous alien autopsy video back in the 90s.
Yeah.
Right? The one that was, you know, a full-blown hoax.
It reminded me of that the little alien driving the human body thing in Men in Black, but not as good as a prop, though, because, you know, the movie made
the homunculus.
That he did. Yeah.
It's a homunculus.
It's a homunculus, man.
So, yeah, the 6-inch alien is interesting. You know, we have x-rays of it and some pictures of a skeleton. What's interesting, one of the things that I find interesting is that it has every bone a human has in the right place, basically the right shape, but it's just a little distorted, you know? So the proportions are distorted, but all the bones pretty much are human.
All right, do you think that that's an actual fetus corpse?
I don't know. It could be 100% a fake, just like the alien autopsy. It could be some weird...
How about a monkey? Some weird monkey
primate?
With no... a primate with no fur or something, a baby one. I don't know. It's either that or it's a complete and utter hoax.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just a misidentification and wishful thinking and all that stuff. It's like a clear and like, I am going to scam people and make all this shit up.
I think the keychain part of it really gives it away, though. I think that's
the keychain. Yeah.
Oh yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
A little made in China tag on it. Yeah.
You know, am I missing something here? Like, do a DNA test on the damn thing.
So he's claiming to be doing a DNA test.
Yep.
And claiming to be examining it, but it's all, oh, we need to raise money in order to do the proper scientific experiments. And I have some undisclosed guy
in some
undisclosed country doing these examinations. And it's all, so the, you know, from listening to this guy, cause I watched a dozen of his YouTube videos and the trailer to his movie and read some of his articles. You know, it's one of these people where I am not convinced that he's not completely full of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not convinced that he believes what he's saying. You know, he could believe some of it. Could believe it somewhat. He could be a total true believer. He could be a total con artist or anywhere in between. It's just, it's hard to say. But he definitely is trying very hard to make a lot of money out of what he's doing.
Yeah.
Which doesn't necessarily mean he's wrong, but it gives him a certain vibe. You know, he's doing things like he has these seminars where he will train you to summon a UFO mentally.
Yep, that's right. He knows the secret.
Oh my God, he's going to that level?
Yes.
He's saying that he can teach you how to attract a UFO to you.
Yes.
That's exactly right.
All right.
He calls it, and he has a thought, he has a name for it. It's called coherent thought. And you use protocols from that he describes as close encounters of the fifth kind.
I got it.
Okay.
George.
Yes.
Role play with me, shall we?
All right, hit it.
So we have traveled a trillion years, but we will wait in the atmosphere of this planet. But we will wait.
Do you think we should maybe like get in touch with a like world government or something? Or
No. We will wait. We will sit here and just wait.
Because, you know, like we've basically spent like pretty much our entire planet's resource to get this ship to this point. You know, it's.
You're young. Don't be anxious. We will wait.
No. I just if there's maybe like a president or like maybe some kind of United Nations of some organization.
Oh look, the light on the dashboard just turned on. Somebody's summoning us.
Is that an official kind of person that represents like a large number of people that we could then maybe, you know, have a liaison with them, or who is that representing that little dashboard light?
This is a hippie in a field in North America.
Okay, so we're gonna travel across the known pretty much galaxy to talk to a hippie.
Does this make sense, guys? I mean, seriously.
And
perfect sense.
I mean, if there,
thank you. Come see us on off our production off Broadway.
What happens, Jay, is that he like points to lights in the sky and says, "That's a UFO."
Right.
He's probably pointing at satellites.
It's turned green, which means we can go.
Did anybody think to ask him why are they waiting to just barely show themselves? Like, come on! How could people be this?
Don't ask that question, Jay.
Well, Jay, I'm sorry you asked that because there is kind of an answer to that.
What?
The aliens are here because they realize we are on the cusp of obtaining, you know, technology that can be a threat to them or to other
iPhone 6
and people on other the iPhone 6, exactly. You know, with all of our nuclear capabilities and mushroom clouds and these sorts of things.
But
so
we've
that's
had,
why the aliens
we've had
have taken
nuclear
an
weapons
interest.
For 70 years.
Yeah, but it's not, you know, it's only a blip in time
so,
because
Evan,
the aliens
are you saying-
have been visiting us for millions of years.
No, guys, we're about to create warp drive.
Yeah. Is that from Cochrane?
First contact. There you go.
Thank you. Of course.
That's got to be it.
Yeah. So
I don't
want to
be a statue.
This guy, the other thing that makes me very suspicious of this guy is that he's doing this. We're right on the cusp. It's going to happen. Governments are going to start disclosing all the real stuff. They're hiding everything from us. I just need a little bit more money, and I'm going to prove all this. It's like I get the same vibe as the free energy people, which he is a free energy
Dennis
person.
Lee.
Yeah.
He
it's
is,
like,
yes.
We're just about to prove the free energy thing, and I just need a little bit more investors to give me some more money, and then we'll get the DNA analysis and the free energy thing and all and everything. It's all a big conspiracy. You know, it's just hard to swallow the whole thing. It's
Evan, was Joe Rogan at all questioning or skeptical at all, or was it just 3 hours of complete agreement? And like, do you think he completely bought into it, or did he have him on the show to kind of just sort of show this is a crazy guy?
It's a great question, George. Joe had him on the show. Joe says because his listeners demanded it.
Okay.
Well, not demanded it, but heavily requested this person be on the show. So that gives you an insight as to the audience of the Joe Rogan show. But in any case, Joe did a better than I expected job of asking him some, you know, questions that a good skeptic would have asked. Now, here's the problem with Joe, though, and he admits this. He wants to believe that this stuff and other things like it are actually true, and therefore he will be much, much more relaxed in his level of standards, right? His threshold by which the person has to, you know, achieve in order to convince Joe that something is right. But Joe's not a dumb person. You know, he knows some things, and he shows that he knows some things. He knows a little bit about science and physics and so forth. And he does ask some decent questions, but at the same time, he really, really has his biases do get the better of him in the end. So.
I've listened to his show. He's a very smart guy. He's a very funny guy. I've liked his stand up, and I've heard a number of his podcasts too. And on some things, he can be very, very skeptical and kind of very. His approach is actually really good. And other times, he'll sort of begin this a little bit of skepticism, and then there's no follow up like at all. Like one response from a person, and then he just kind of stops that kind of front. And it's a shame because I bet. If he had some kind of epiphany moment, I think there could be a real turnaround for him because he is a deductive kind of smart guy. He's not a completely credulous, from what I can tell anyway, from the limited amount I've listened to him.
But what I want to know is, why is there a 6-inch tall alien that looks more human than any alien has the right to look? That's what I want to know.
Right. Well, yeah, that's
and, right. And why will it have DNA if it's alien?
Because they seeded the Earth, Steve. Come on, there's always a good explanation.
Yeah, I know. They always have their hand-waving BS explanation, but it doesn't make any scientific sense.
Yeah, I mean,
sense
look at
whatsoever.
Prometheus. They were big and muscular, you know. these guys
don't
are
even
and puny.
Start on Prometheus. Yeah.
Prometheus.
Oh. George, you love that movie, right?
Love it. Love it. I have it running on a loop in my head all day long.
I'm in it for the money. Yeah.
Oh boy,
it's a good line from that. So there you go. That's the latest with Joe. And
all right, so Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Yep, I'm going to play for you last week's noisy, and it was up to you, the listening audience, to guess exactly what this noisy was. Here we go.
Yeah, you're looking a little hot. All your calls will be a little early.
Okay.
That
looks good here.
That is a whistle pig. No, we can't do that two weeks in a row.
Yeah, we can't.
Well, we knew it was a NASA beep communication with somebody in outer space, but we didn't know, you know, what mission. What was it?
Well, George, what do you think? Have you heard that before somewhere?
That is actually the mission that the band Rush used for the song Countdown.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's exactly correct. Yes. STS number one. Space Shuttle Columbia.
Right.
April 12, 1981. Yep. And that was a little part of the communique going on between Mission Control and astronauts Young and Crippen in the shuttle itself.
Awesome.
Excitement so grand.
It's the final countdown.
Not that one, no. Stop it. No, wrong hair. More kimonos, less hair.
I'm very proud of our audience. So many correct guesses. I was very, very pleased with everyone this past week. So thank you all for playing and submitting your correct guesses. I drew randomly from all the correct guesses, and Ross Rawlings, you are the winner this week because I drew your name. So well done, Ross. You are now
Ross Rawlings. Fantastic.
He is now in the running for the Is that the dating game?
Tell him what he's won. Tell him what he's won.
Well, Ross, you are now in the running to join us for an episode of Science or Fiction on an episode of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. We will have the drawing at the beginning of 2014. So congratulations. I didn't know you carried a little bugle in your back pocket there, George. That's very handy.
I'm just happy to see you.
Logic puzzle this week, ladies and gentlemen. Get your thinking caps on and try this one. A man from the Ukraine had three sons. The first son was named Rab, and he became a lawyer.
Isn't it Rob, like Rob?
It's R-A-B.
Yeah.
How would you pronounce that, George?
Well, I would say Rob.
Okay.
If he's Ukrainian. And don't say the Ukraine, just say Ukraine.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
Man from the France. Is that similar to like saying the France?
Exactly. The France, or the England. Yeah.
A man from The Hague had three sons.
Go ahead, Evan. Get it right this time.
A man from Ukraine had three sons. The first son was named Rob, and he became a lawyer. The second son was named Irma, and he became a soldier. The third son became a sailor. So, what was his name?
Got it.
So go ahead, give us your answer to that logic puzzle. WTN@theskepticsguide.org is the email. Or you can post it on the forums at sguforums.com. Tune up your thinking caps. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan. We have a few questions this week. I don't know if we'll get through all of them, but let's start with this one. This one comes from Jonathan Nonan from New York. Jonathan writes, I'm a software engineer originally from Dominican Republic. Is it the Dominican Republic? I have been a listener of the show since 2010, and every week I am looking forward to a new SGU chapter. When I was a kid, I am 28, he's still a kid, back in the DR, yeah. A journalist made an investigation about a magnetic pole in one remote corner of the country, Barahona, in the southeast of the island. It always puzzled me. The place looks like a hill. However, everything you place on the ground rolls in the opposite direction, uphill. All objects, no matter what material they are pulled upwards. You can look at dozens of videos on YouTube by searching the string Polo Magnetico Barahona. The common and most simple explanation is that the place is an optical illusion. It's not that I do not believe it, I do not understand it. I have been looking for explanations, but none of them satisfy my curiosity. In my little research, I didn't find any other place where this phenomenon is happening. If you can explain this phenomenon, I will appreciate it.
This phenomenon was like one of the first ones that I debunked on my own. I figured it out by myself, and I was really proud of myself. And it was a long time ago. Thank you. So it's known by many names, and there are hundreds of locations around the world that have this thing happening. But first, these are called, they're known by different terms, gravity hill, magnetic hill, spooky mystery hill, a mystery spot or gravity road. There's lots of different names, different, it's funny, but.
It sounds like an episode of Scooby-Doo or something.
Yeah.
Right?
Different interpretations of the names that these places get around the world all revolve around that theme. Something about, you know, a road or a hill being magnetic or spooky.
Fried hill, chicken hill, pig hill, spooky hill.
Whistle pig hill.
Whistle pig hill. That's about it.
So these places are where the lay of the land produces an optical illusion. The emailer was absolutely correct. Typically, these are roads that have a tiny downhill slope, but happen to appear like they're going uphill. A common test that you'll see someone do on YouTube is they'll turn their car off, put it in neutral, and then they take their foot off the gas and the brake and everything. There's, you know, no interaction, and the car just starts rolling. It looks like uphill. The illusion is another example that people are easy to fool because of the way our senses work. And we've talked about this on the show before. The way our senses construct reality is happening incredibly fast in our brain. And our brain is constantly trying to make sense of what it sees. Like, what cues do we use to tell spatially how big things are, how far things are, and what their orientation is compared to everything else that we're seeing? And our brain has to make decisions with the information that it has in front of them. And also taking into account or, you know, affecting what you're seeing is your bias and your preconceived notions of how things are supposed to behave. So in this case, Typically, when we are outside and trying to orient ourselves, the horizon comes into play, particularly in a case like this where there's something going uphill or downhill and we need to know spatially where it is in comparison to where we are. The other big thing is the angle of the trees and the surrounding hills and the land. It can and does happen, and like I said, there's hundreds of places around the world where this is, where it actually looks the opposite of what the land is actually doing, which is weird, I know, but it does happen, and thousands, if not millions of people have been fooled over the years at these locations. But that's it. You know, magicians use the fact that we are susceptible to illusions to fool us all the time. You can go on YouTube and you know, fall prey to illusions that are even on a 2D screen. We're that susceptible to them. And that is the explanation. And even though we'd like to think that there's something cool going on, you know, there's some type of cosmic thing that's reversing the magnetic force. No, sorry. It's just your eyes playing tricks on you.
It's not a vortex.
The magnetic thing doesn't even make sense because things that are not ferromagnetic are also affected.
Plastic bottles. That's right.
I mean, it would have to be a gravity phenomenon. There's an anti-gravity, you know, field or something there. Cyclists, bike riders know about this phenomenon. You know what they call it?
Something slope or, yeah.
It's called a false flat.
False flat. There you go. Oh.
Yeah. So when it looks like you're on a level field, but you're actually slightly going uphill. And so it's harder. So you, if you don't account for that, you may get tuckered out because you think you're actually
gear, yeah.
pedaling up gear uphill and you don't realize it because the optical illusion, it looks flat.
My dad years ago, like when I was a kid and we would drive in the Lincoln Tunnel to get into New York City or the Holland Tunnel. Now the first like third of the tunnel, you're going at a pretty decent angle sort of downwards, but there's no sense of it because you're in this tunnel. He would put the car in neutral and he would sort of say like, are we flat right now? Or what do you think is our position right now? And I would say, yeah, we're totally flat. Like it just feels like all of a sudden we're, you know, totally level. And he put the car in neutral and we just roll down until you get to the bottom. Where it flattens out, where the car would then slow down. And then he would sort of, you know, you would notice that you're going now uphill in the last part of it. That was the first time as a kid that like this perception thing was like, you don't trust what you're seeing. Don't trust what you're feeling. Don't trust what you're seeing necessarily.
Yeah. I've noticed that in long tunnels as well. You lose your perspective.
Yeah.
And it's because it's all relative. It's hard to know if you're going down or going up.
Cause there's no horizon. It's that false horizon, which is also my favorite Schwarzenegger film too. False horizon.
Oh,
this
God.
Movie, everything rolls uphill.
All right, one more question. This one comes from Woody, and Woody writes, I was recently in a discussion about Tourette syndrome, and to get quickly to the point, minor forms of said syndrome. It was my assertion that minor forms were more akin to compulsion or, in more extreme cases, OCD, and that Tourette was specifically in the extreme. I remember you touching shortly on this on the SGU and searched your blogs to see if you had written more in depth to no avail. I was hoping that you could give me a short rundown on the mechanics. Okay, so sure, I'll be happy to do that, Woody. Tourette syndrome is a neurological disorder, first described by a famous French neurologist, Tourette, which involves essentially tics. A tic is an involuntary movement of some kind. It could be a moving a part of your body. It could be a vocalization, clearing your throat. Anything like that is a tic. And it's involuntary in that people do it against
involuntarily.
They don't want to do it. But the reason why I'm clarifying it is because most people with these tics can suppress them for a short period of time. So it's not involuntary like a seizure is involuntary where you have no control over it. It's involuntary, but maybe it's better to think of it that the desire to do the movement involuntary. But
okay.
You can temporarily suppress it, but when people try to do that, they describe it as like this growing itch, this growing desire to do the tic. And that can only be relieved by executing the tic. Right? So it essentially becomes impossible to suppress it for any length of time.
It sounds horrifying.
It is. In its severe form, it's very debilitating.
Debilitating.
Now, he brings up obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD, and there is a relationship between OCD and Tourette, but it's not just one of extremity. It's not like extreme cases are OCD and mild cases are Tourette, or the other way around. It's that you can have both Tourette's and OCD, and they do frequently occur together. So does Tourette's and ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. What obsessive compulsive disorder is, you could think of that as the mental version of a tic. It is an involuntary thought or obsession. So the notion that you have to do things a certain number of times, for example, or that you have to wash your hands, or there are people who have obsessive checking behavior, like they might turn a light switch on and off 20 times. Or, you know, I've read of a case where somebody had this obsession that they, while driving, that they ran somebody over. And so they kept having to turn around and going back to see if they, if there was a dead body in the street. And they just would get into this endless loop of going back and checking to see if they'd run somebody over. There are similar parts of the brain, similar phenomenon. OCD is mental, tics are physical. But they're very similar phenomenologically. So, but you can have very mild Tourette syndrome. In fact, there's a lot of people, you've probably have seen them, you know, who have these little tics, you know, that are not that bad and not debilitating in any way. They're just odd. All the way up to people who, their tic is swearing, so-called coprolalia. That's about 10 to 15% of people with Tourette's will have the coprolalia. You know, they'll not just of clearing the throat or some vocalization, but for whatever reason, they are, their tic is saying something that is socially unacceptable. And it's absolutely culture specific. You know, it's not like these people in different cultures say the same thing. It's the tic is saying something that is a swear word in your culture that is, will be socially offensive or inappropriate in the current context.
Was it thought at some point that perhaps Tourette's was misinterpreted as possession?
Oh, I'm sure, you know, going back, absolutely. Yeah. If you read classic descriptions of people who were thought to be
witches and stuff,
possessed by demons, these were people probably with neurological disorders. I'm sure Tourette's is on the list, seizures. Right. You know, if you had a fit, they didn't think, oh, he's having an electric discharge in the brain. They would think you were possessed by a demon.
Right.
Absolutely.
Do you guys have any OCD stuff? Do any of you guys have any kind of little compulsions?
I assume by your question that you do.
No, I don't think I do. I mean, it's that weird thing of like determining what is sort of tradition. I'm in a weird way. Like we, you know, everybody has whatever they do. Like when I'm setting up my drums, let's say, it's a certain order that I have to do it. If it doesn't happen in that order, it's okay. I don't feel like the world's going to collapse, but there is a certain pleasure in knowing, oh, this goes and this goes and this goes. Like
it feels right.
Yeah.
So I had two very mild OCD type things when I was younger that I basically outgrew.
So you think?
Yeah. Well, they're still present a little bit, but I don't actually do them anymore.
Really?
I had an even number bias where it just, even numbers feel right and odd numbers don't. So I had a bias towards doing things an even number of times, or I had a completion sort of OCD where, like, if I did something on one side, it felt better if I did it on the other side. Or like if I tapped one finger, I had to tap all of my fingers.
Yeah.
But that was very little things like that, very subtle. And then just when I was younger, I don't do them anymore as adults, but I still, sometimes they're like way, way deep back buried in my head that there's this little,
cool.
It feels a little right to complete things or to have an even number of things,
right,
you know?
Right.
I definitely had some as a kid. Like the light switch thing sparked a memory. I think I used to just like keep flipping the light switch for no reason.
Yeah.
Until I just felt like, okay, I'm done with that. But
you know what I mean? You just wanted to be in a disco. That's all. You were just hoping for the strobe effect.
I spatially, things like I was particular about where things were. Mm-hmm. I would have like a fear, like something was going to fall off the nightstand, and I would keep pushing it more and more into the nightstand. Mm. So it was like ridiculously in the center type of deal.
That's a good one.
This isn't genetic, is it?
Yeah, sure. Predisposition.
Oh
sure.
Boy.
I definitely grew out of them. Like if anything, I wish I was a little more OCD now, because I'd be cleaner and get more stuff done. Like Steve's like, I'm OCD. I had to complete medical school.
The thing is, what's interesting is that anxiety and obsessive compulsiveness, a little bit of that is very practical, sure, and adaptive and beneficial. There's an upside and a downside, and most people are somewhere in the middle. Obviously, if you had no anxiety whatsoever, you'd walk out into traffic, you know. Or if you have no, you would have no personal hygiene. Your house would be a mess. You have to be motivated to do stuff by a little bit of anxiety, a little bit of obsessiveness. But too much and it starts to become counterproductive. Yeah. And there's, you know, there's a bell curve. And what we're really talking about with OCD is people just at one end of the spectrum.
It's fascinating to think that there's a healthy amount of OCD, which you would just say in the range of whatever we would say is normal, that it isn't obstructive.
Healthy.
Yeah, healthy.
That, and maybe along with that comes these little quirks that are benign, but that are just interesting quirks of how our brain
but
works.
Most like, people that are successful, not successful, but most people, I mean, Tycho Brahe, when he was sitting, you know, looking at stars night after night after night, I mean, that's an obsessive, that's a compulsion. You know, all the people that, you know, Gregor Mendel on some level was probably obsessive, you know. You have to be on some level, or whether you're, you know, painting or an artist or something, there is some kind of a compulsion and an obsession that can drive stuff. And that's why a lot of those people don't have social skills necessarily or don't do well outside of their compulsion.
Right.
And yet they can be influential.
Think about the entire skeptical movement is based upon compulsion. Sure. Somebody is wrong on the internet. Sure. Why do we care so much that people believe things that are not reasonable or that are unscientific?
Well, what are we going to not correct them, Steve? I mean, come on, seriously.
I'm just saying, this is a good, healthy compulsion. It bothers us emotionally, so we are motivated to do something about
it. Right, until it's comments on my Facebook page correcting, you know, some obscure reference which was wrong. And it's like, okay, fine, yes, technically, you're correct. I'm sorry that my joke didn't adhere to the, you know, 14th century standards of the Fibonacci system the way I was implying at, you know, 37 characters in. I'm sorry, you're correct.
Right.
It's much funnier your way.
The words you were saying were correct, George, but tonally, you were completely incorrect.
Yes, your version is much funnier. I'm sorry.
there's our recurring discussion of pedantry.
Yes.
Right? People who are pedantic. A certain amount of being pedantic is good. It means being a good scientist, detail-oriented. You could spin it all in a very positive way. You know, you get the facts
upspin
right.
Or downspin.
Yeah, or you could say you're obsessed with irrelevant details that don't matter. And both could be correct. It's just a matter of degree. Fascinating the way our brains work.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week with four items. I know how you guys love this. The theme is the internet. Four facts about the internet, only three of them are true. Are you all ready?
Do it.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Item number one. Greater than 60% of upstream traffic is comprised of torrent files, while Netflix by itself represents one-third of peak download traffic. Item number two. Amazon.com benefited from the popularity of the Yahoo search engine, which listed search results alphabetically. Item number three. North America has the highest internet penetration at 78.6%, while Africa has the lowest at 15.6%. And item number four, in 1999, Congressman Peter Schnell proposed House Bill 602P, allowing the U.S. Postal Service to charge a 5-cent surcharge for each email sent. The bill died in response to public outrage.
Jeez.
George, you were the first one to utter a noise, which means that you get to go first. I know you didn't know the rules, but that's no excuse, so.
I would totally believe that in the first one that Netflix has that much of the share of, and that the torrent and the Netflix percentages, I would think that's correct. Amazon benefiting from the alphabetical listing, I also would think that is correct. I think the percentages seem right between North America and Africa, 78 and 15.6. That seems legit. The one that stood out to me is the fourth one, that the 5-cent surcharge, because that's been one of those kind of internet myths which has been passed around forever and ever. Even though you said that it didn't pass, to think that Congress in 1999, seeing as the internet sort of really sort of hit it off in 93, that they would be that far ahead of the curve and thinking of having a 5 cent surcharge. I think that's the fake one. So I would say the surcharge one is the fake one.
Okay, Bob.
Oh boy. I hear often that torrent just dominates internet traffic. So I could buy 60% upstream. Even higher wouldn't be too surprising. And Netflix, man, I watch Netflix every damn night. I'm not surprised at that. Even that could be higher, and I wouldn't be too surprised. Internet penetration, North America at 78. Yeah, you know, I'm kind of not sure about that one, because I would think that other countries like Japan or some other countries would have higher internet penetration than even we do. But I think because maybe something about using North America instead of the United States kind of is getting my attention. And then this, the 5 cent surcharge. So the fact that somebody proposed a bill, it doesn't concern me or get my attention as much as the Amazon one. I mean, I don't think I've ever used Yahoo search engine. It just makes no sense to me that the search results will be listed alphabetically. To me, that's just like ridiculous. That can't be right. Because it's just too easy to name yourself something to get yourself high on the list. It just seems silly to have your results listed alphabetically. I'm just going to go for that one. That's got to be fiction.
Okay. And Evan?
The congressman, 5 cent surcharge for each email sent. I have some recollection of this. I'm not sure if this is a twisting of this somehow, but I'm going to say that one's correct. Okay. The highest internet penetration at 78.6%. I suppose so. We're judging the continents here. Therefore, well, we're Antarctica. You'd think Antarctica, I think, would have the lowest internet penetration, but I guess we're not counting that. So if given the remaining continents, I suppose Africa's going to, I imagine, have the lowest. It's such a big continent. I think that one's correct. Therefore, it's down to Amazon and the popularity of the Yahoo search engine, or greater than 60% of upstream traffic, torrent files. So it kind of leaves this Yahoo and Amazon.com one. Yeah, I don't know. Results alphabetically seems a little simplistic. So I guess for the same reason, Bob, I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, and Jay.
Okay, I'll take them in order. The first one, about 60% of upstream traffic is torrent files. That one is absolutely true. The glut of upstream torrent files is that's true because of how much downloading that's happening. They can track those types of things. We know what websites people are going to get the files, and it's hard to track, I would imagine, but I'm sure that there's a way to gauge that, and I do believe that there is a phenomenal amount of file sharing going on. The second one, about Amazon benefiting from Yahoo. Yes, that is true, by the way. And Yahoo definitely used to display their things in alphabetical order.
Really? What the hell?
That's 100%
true. Stupid.
North America.
Stupid Yahoo. Stupid.
Some Yahoos are stupid.
That's why it's called Yahoo.
The third one about North America having the highest penetration and Africa has the lowest. Those numbers seem right to me as well. So the 5 cent one is absolutely false. Absolutely false.
Okay, so we have a split decision here. But you all agree on the first one, so we'll start there, that greater than 60% of upstream traffic is comprised of torrent files, while Netflix by itself represents 1/3 of peak download traffic. We all think that one is true, and that one is science.
Yeah. Yep.
And not surprising.
Hey, you okay there?
So, obviously, it does depend a little bit on what resource you're looking at for who's studying internet traffic and reporting on it. Most of the studies come from companies that sell products and services to ISPs to regulate their traffic. So they may not be the most objective sources, but I tried to find as many sources for this as I could, and I'll have links to this. So, 60% or 61% specifically, so greater than 60% of upstream traffic, just upstream. For total traffic, it's actually much less, like 20% for the torrent files. Some listed as peer-to-peer, but I guess most of that is torrent. Some listed as torrent traffic. And a recent 2012 study showed that Netflix represents a third. Now, this is download rather than upload, and it was during the peak times. So one-third of peak download traffic.
Yeah, and snow days and after 5 o'clock.
Right. And the different surveys whacked up internet traffic in different ways, like how much is on web pages versus blogs, you know, versus video. Video is obviously taking off where web pages kind of peaked and they're on the, going down. I saw another study. There was so much information about, you know, statistical information on the internet out there that I could choose from. One recent study showed that more than half of website visits are by robots rather than
people. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which wasn't surprising.
Like data?
Yeah, and a lot of that is malicious.
Yeah, definitely a lot of it's malicious. And, you know, keep in mind that Google has its tentacles out there all the time, which, you know, I think is a good thing for, you know, from a data perspective. It's mm-hmm. fantastic. But at the same time, I mean, you know, you ever track, you can have software that can show you all the times that your IP address is pinged.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, the more popular your IP address is, like a public website that might have just regular traffic going to it or whatever, like it's scary. It's insane. And it's not by human hands.
Right. You know,
I'm sure the vast minority of it is by humans.
Vast minority. I always like that phrase. All right. Let's go to number three. North America has the highest internet penetration at 78.6%, while Africa has the lowest at 15.6%. You all also agree that that one is science, and that one is also science.
Yeah.
So far, so good.
Wow.
So yeah, it's not surprising that Africa is so low, or that North America is high. I thought, you know, some people might think that Europe, for example, has a higher penetration than North America, but it doesn't. It's lower. Asia is actually quite low. This is broken up by continent, obviously. So whereas like Japan may have a high penetration, Asia actually is low, just above Africa. All right, here we go. Let's go back to number two. Amazon.com benefited from the popularity of the Yahoo search engine, which listed search results alphabetically. Jay and George think this one is science. Evan and Bob, you think this one is fiction.
Georgie!
Hold my hand, Bob.
And this one
not gonna
is
help.
Science.
Thank you.
Dang. Ah.
Sorry, Bob and Evan.
I mean,
give me my hand back, Bob.
That was surprising.
That didn't help at all.
And
very. I wish I used Yahoo now because I went from Metacrawler right to Google. And I think I used Yahoo literally three times in my life to search.
So, do you guys know what Amazon.com was called before it was Amazon.com?
Oh my God!
Zingy
you know
zing
that.
Zingers.
Zamazon.
It was called Kadabra.com, as in abracadabra.
Yeah.
But they thought it sounded too much like cadaver.
Yeah, nice. I know a website that's abracadabra. Really cool stuff.
And so they changed the name to Amazon. And
of course.
You know, some references that I found said that they specifically changed their name to something with an A to get high on the Yahoo listings. Others that it was just a happy consequence of doing that. Some credited the fact that Yahoo is so dominant now with their early boost from being listed, you know, on the first page alphabetically. I don't know. That's why I just said that they benefited, not that it's responsible for their popularity. I don't know that you could justify that claim. But
I
certainly,
love Amazon.com.
It certainly didn't hurt, you know, being listed high up in the order alphabetically.
Why would Yahoo make a search engine that would list themselves second to last? That's all I want to know.
Because they wanted to stick it to zebra.com. Yeah.
Are you guys aware of the Amazon logo? I'm sure you're all aware of this, but when this was first pointed out to me, the smile, because you have the word Amazon and it looks like a face. Well, the smile actually is pointing from A to Z. I just thought that was cool. That's like, you know, they cover everything. You go A to Z.
Yeah, right.
No, it's just neat. It's just one of those design things like you never see it, and then when you see it, you can't not see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's the FedEx logo has an arrow in it.
That's
I love that type of stuff.
I just noticed it. George, awesome.
There you go.
One quick interesting fact about Amazon, you know, or fact or whatever, but Amazon was one of the companies that helped write modern shopping software.
Yeah.
They came up with did they come up with it? Whatever. They made it popular. They made that way of checking out and their processes. They are a phenomenal internet company. They are a phenomenal, phenomenal aggregator of companies' goods.
Alligator.
When you first heard about the concept of Amazon, whenever that was, 94, 95, when you first heard the commercial, I remember being in the car and hearing a commercial for this and the idea that there were like, you know, millions of books available somewhere through the internet. Did you guys think that would work?
I did, but I was I was an early internet optimist.
Right.
I have to say.
I remember thinking.
But George.
I don't remember what I thought.
George, I didn't think that their other model of aggregating other people's goods was going to work. I thought that was very strange.
Right. I thought it was a brilliant idea that would never work. I was like, that is the coolest idea and people are never going to want to use it.
Well, we do.
Exactly.
Let's go on to number four. In 1999, Congressman Peter Schnell proposed House Bill 602P, allowing the U.S. Postal Service to charge a 5-cent surcharge for each email sent. The bill died in response to public outrage. George, you're right. This is an urban myth. It comes up all the time. It's the never-ending, oh, they're going to charge for email. The Postal Service is upset that they're losing all of their revenue from regular mail, so they're going to try to make it back by taxing email.
Yeah,
it's
whatever.
All nonsense.
Yay. It's complete hooey.
Yay. The whole thing?
I never get this right. It's 100% nonsense.
It's 100%. There's also some clues in there that I let. This is the – no, there's not. There is. First of all, Peter Schnell never existed. You might not that you know every congressman that ever lived. But
Max Schnell?
I should have Yahooed that.
Let me check my list of congressmen here.
But here's the other thing. This is a little detail, but House bills are numbered followed by the letter H. And Senate bills by the letter S. There's no such thing as a bill. 602P doesn't even make any sense.
You said 2P.
You are so clever. Mm.
But I didn't make that up. This is the spam, right? This is the bill that if you look up House Bill 602P, it's this. But the people who made it up didn't even number it right. They didn't even use a House bill numbering system, you know.
Sweet.
If you take every third letter in that sentence, it spells out Steve is awesome too, which is really annoying.
Stupid memory.
All right, so Jay and George, you both won this week, so I have a runoff bonus question.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay. What was the number one trending Google search term for 2012?
Gangnam Style.
Very close. Number two.
That was number two?
Yep.
Son of a bitch.
That's pretty good, George.
For the fact that I haven't slept in a month and my brain is completely fried, I'm going to say, sadly, Call Me Maybe?
Nope.
Nah. Sandy Hook?
Number three was Hurricane Sandy. Mm-hmm. And despite the fact that this was an election year in the United States, the number one trending Google search term in 2012 was Whitney Houston.
What?
Oh yeah,
Whitney Houston.
No.
Oh my God.
Wow. Yep.
Wow.
What
sad.
did she die or something?
Always love you.
Yeah, I knew that.
Right.
Wow. So I get the science and fiction right, and I get the close to all. Wow. This is guys. You know what? You've just made my. What time is it?
You've made my picosecond.
You made my minute 10:28.
All right, Jay, what's your quote for this week?
My quote for this week is, neither evolution nor creation qualifies as a scientific theory.
I have a sneaking suspicion I know who said that.
Who do you think it is, Steve?
Was that Dwayne the Galloping Gish?
Dwayne Gish! And why am I quoting him, guys?
I thought it was Whitney Houston.
Attached to this. Neither evolution nor creation qualifies... Dwayne Gish died on 3/5/2013.
Yes. And we will talk next week because we just discovered it during our actual recording that he died yesterday. So we will, probably discuss it in more detail.
Look, there's no proof that he's died.
Week,
scientists don't agree that he died. There's a lot of debate about whether or not he's dead. I don't think we should jump. Look, we should be able to teach the fact that he might be alive. Or that he might be dead, because there's no consensus on this.
How can you even define death?
How can you exactly
life, death? It's a false dichotomy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And George, the name of your show is what?
It's called Stimulus Response. Is the name of the whole evening, because it's all sciencey.
Yep, and that's on Friday, April 5th, and then Nexus is on the 6th and 7th, and we have activities going on.
Hey, we have a new event planned. We're going to have a showdown between Michael Shermer and Massimo Piliucci over the science of ethics. That's going to be interesting. They're going to go mano a mano.
Yeah, exactly. A little gunslinger action.
Yeah, Steve, I didn't know we locked that in yet, so I'm glad to hear that.
Yes. Julia Galef is going to moderate. Next week is show 400.
Congratulations, right. Guys. That is really awesome. That is really, really meaningful and fantastic. And
Thanks, George.
So cool.
Hey, George, you just passed 300.
I just passed 300. Yeah, but that's
300 too.
Yeah, but you guys are 400. 400. Tremendous, guys.
All right. Thanks, George.
Thanks, George.
Thanks, buddy.
And thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Yeah,
thanks, Dr.
Good
Steve.
To be here. Good week.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website, or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.